So tonight, we'll be studying the eight kinds of consciousness. And this is class 7 in module 17. So I thought tonight it would be a good time to just zoom out and get a view. Where are we at this point? We've done a lot of different individual classes and different style of teaching because each class was unique in a way. Some were videos, audio, one was a film, one was audio tape. So tonight I just wanted to make a few comments from a zoom out perspective, and then we'll zoom in again to these narrow little factors of the skandhas and the consciousnesses and how we put together our little self. So it'll be tiny. So the question I first started with is, where are we in module 17? So as you know, we're looking at self and selflessness. So we're looking at what actually makes up the self, this self that we carry around that we're so sure is me, you know, and we feel so identified with it. Well, what is it, actually? So this is a real investigation to figure that out. And primarily what we learn is it's a false belief that we are permanent, we think we are, that we're singular, and that we're independent. So we've used those words before in the earlier classes. And Andy Carr adds important. Now that was really cute, I thought. That was cute, you know, Andy. Good job, Andy. And we know Andy Carr from Kempo Soltam Gyamso's classes at in Vermont, where we used to go. So he wrote a wonderful book that's in my bag, Contemplating Reality. We've been working with that too. So you could say, like, why do we even care about this? You know, isn't this the most irritating thing you can think of to actually study? But like I said, I'm not a good salesman for the Dharma. Oh, you can. Okay. Recipes that don't work, I don't know. Because the point is, we want to be liberated from suffering. That's really it. And that was what the Buddha started talking about, was suffering. So really, that's what we really want. And we feel that we're stuck in our little world, our little patterns, and there's a sense of feeling trapped by that. So we're exploring how to get out of that little trap. And I think tonight is kind of an interesting turning point in that it's the eve of a transition in our country to a new president and a sense of real uncertainty and could be discomfort or could be comfort depending on your viewpoint. But really a change, and we can feel some kind of the ground is shifting. And I've been thinking a lot about what happened in Tibet in like 1950, 53, when the communists came into Tibet. And I've just recently read this book called From the Lion's Jaws, and it's about Trungpa Rinpoche's escape from Tibet in 1959. And it really gave me a perspective on his life and what that felt like. So a 1,000-year culture that was so developed and highly evolved and beautiful ritual objects and ways of doing things and a society that was problem. Obviously, there are problems everywhere, but basically things went along, you know? Things went along, and there were realized teachers, and people had a chance to actually study the Dharma and attain realization. And then when the communists came in, there was a shift that happened very fast. It was a real unraveling. and a lot of destruction. The high lamas were shot right there in their monasteries. The monks were shot, and people were hauled off to jail and tortured, and people tried to escape. So it was a huge amount of upheaval. And I've been thinking about what happened at that point when they knew, and some of the lamas actually could tell what was going to happen through divination and other means. And they knew there was going to be a lot of destruction. And they ended up actually giving the highest teachings to a lot of people. They did not hold back at all. They knew that there would not be an opportunity to actually talk freely and to teach. And they gathered people in the monasteries, and they gave them these teachings. And they're really about being present and working with whatever occurs and whatever arises with a sense of equanimity. So without for and against, without a lot of anger or hostility, but being right there in the moment, in the situation. So the root of all of that understanding comes from selflessness and a real understanding of what creates a self and how we get hooked and how we have emotional reactions and how we solidify our world. So what we're teaching and what we're working with here on many levels is really this teaching of understanding the lack of solid self, which, you know, it's hard to imagine, but there's a sense of really processing that over time. It takes time. And the reason we're doing the Heart Sutra is to hear those words, no eye, no ear, no nose, etc. And we think, what in the world is this? And that's the point. What in the world is this? So it's a sense of questioning, and it encourages us to investigate. Not to just say, oh, well, I'll never get it, or not to just say, you know, this is too confusing, but to actually hang in there. So we're trying to present different ways of going in to actually accessing this understanding. So what is it that actually liberates us? It's actually our mind. The mind is our power to have a sense of freedom in whatever situation we're in, whatever our circumstances are. And that's what I think really came across for me reading this book about Tibet at the time the communists came in, that people went to prison, and I've heard teachers talk about it as graduate school. I mean, really, you know. And that's because they were in a concentrated situation with very high teachers, and they did, in secret, communicate with each other and teach each other. So really, it's about working with your mind. So fundamentally, that is really the path in terms of freedom. And how in the world do we learn how to do this? So one aspect is that we listen to teachings about people who've actually had some realization and they're further along on the path than we are, because it's a hard journey to figure this out all by yourself, as you can well imagine. So that's why we study different teachers and teachings. And we don't take those people as you know, any kind of gods or anything like that. It's just that they're further along and their knowledge can be shared with us and we can learn what they learned. And the other aspect is through our own meditation practice, we can actually discover the truth. And I think we all have a sense of what that is when we sit and meditate and there's like this ocean of thoughts that kind of wash over us one after another, and then there might be just a gap in there. And we remember we're actually doing meditation and we're sitting in a chair or on the cushion, and we remember that there's a technique, and we come back to the breath, and we come back to the out-breath, and we experience that momentary sense of being present. That clearness through to this still space or openness. That's the mind and prajna. So prajna is superior seeing, and that kind of opening is from that application of mind to that practice. So this the candles actually that we use up here actually represent they actually are shining light, you could say. The candle represents shining light on our confusion. So it's the light, you could say, of wisdom that shines forth. And we experience that ourselves when we meditate, that sense of that openness. So that also means that we're also opening to our Buddha nature. And we'll be probably doing a unit on that at some point more. We'll go into that more, what that is. But that's taught to be our fundamental nature, that's what is within us. And the light is also in reference to that. So I copied this from this. I was looking over this thing on death and dying, and I had this section at the very end. It was just a sheet that was the symbols that went on the shrine when you did a ceremony for someone who died. And I saw the one for the flame, the candle. It said, we nurture the flame of prajna, which is awakened intellect, which illumines reality as it is. So it shows us the way things really are. So that's what we're working for and learning and trying to understand what it is that we misunderstand about self and we solidify, and what it is that we misunderstand about our perception of the world. So the path of meditation takes you a long way. I mean, it really is quite a vast, extensive path. But the path of study is also very important because it gives you the direction. It shows you the way to go and also will help to move you further on that path. Without those two things, you could meditate but not really understand or have a deeper understanding of your mind and kind of the full path. Or you could study without meditating and it would all just be concept. And then what's the point of that? Because fundamentally we're working with going beyond concept. And I think that's what we start to sense when we do the Heart Sutra. We're going beyond concept because how would you ever figure this out? It's just not going to work. So I said that we can learn from those who have gone before, the Buddha and those that understood his teachings. And actually, these teachers reframed the teachings in every generation, which I think is really interesting. Without bringing the essence to a culture, people misunderstand. And that's why Trungpa Rinpoche gave up his robes and this whole monastic trapping that he grew up in that culture. And that would never have been done. But in the West, the students were basically seeing him in a certain way just because he was wearing robes. And it prevented him from really working with them and their minds. So he was willing to basically give that up. So Trungpa Rinpoche also talked about the Dharma is like fresh bread. You might have the same recipe and the same ingredients, but you have to keep baking the bread all the time, and it tastes fresh and the smell is there. So this is a living teaching and a living truth. Um, So in class two, we listened to a talk by Pema Chodron from this program at Gampo Abbey a couple years ago that John Roberts actually told me about, called Making Friends with Yourself, Self, Selflessness, and the Roots of Attachment. And Pema in that presented three numbers. She said, I'll talk about the 5, the 8, and the 12. Does anyone remember what they are? The 5? Five skandhas. The 8 consciousnesses. The 12 nidanas. Right. And I said, oh, Eric and I worked on this, and we're just going to do the 8. Like, we were like, we'll barely get through that. Enough. Right? That's enough. This is hard for us. This is as far as we're going to go. But then, you know, it's so obvious that that's not really where we end. It's so obvious. We've already, Joseph even introduced the eight consciousnesses last week when he talked about the skandhas and consciousness. So, okay, here we go. So we are going to study the 8 consciousnesses. I'm going to cover that today. And next week, the 12 nidanas, and Michael Fagan will cover that. And then our last class, Erica will do a wrap-up, so and question and answer, so a lot more time for questions. So, okay, so I think we're going to jump in here. So I think everybody, we don't have any brand new people here right now, so you came before, so you heard Joseph's talk, so I think everybody, all the new people, I guess, left. So as you know, the 5 skandhas are heaps, and now we're zooming in, which is back down into the nitty-gritty little, you know, kind of tiny little seeds of what we put together for ourself. So we're going to look again, and I, on this sheet, I did list them out because I wanted to just have them in front of us, but we've gone through this a couple times. So the 5 skandhas are the aggregates, and they're quite primitive, almost pre-thought. I use material from The Indestructible Truth by Reggie Ray, so you can, basically, I put a lot of that material just here because it was quite concise, but you can do more searching on your own, and we might put more things online. The way he described form as physical elements, earth, water, fire, air, as well as the 5 sense organs. Okay, so here's a key to where we're going. The eye, ear, nose, tongue, and body, and their corresponding sense objects, the visual, auditory, olfactory, gustatory, and tactile. Form refers to those momentary events that we experience as physical. Feeling is the second one, the primitive sensations of, we say, like or dislike, positivity, pleasure, negativity, pain, or neutrality, indifference, that attends any experience that we have, however momentary and fleeting. And the third one is perception, experience of rudimentary perception, in which we recognize and type what we see, hear, smell, taste, touch, and think. So I actually have a question here myself. So I was thinking, when we hear motorcycles outside, that's a perception of sound, and then we label it as motorcycle. So does that fall under the third as perception, or does it go into the fourth as karmic formation? What do you think, Mike?
Well, it's labeling. Because we have to draw off. We have a very complex system of labeling, and we have reference points. And all those reference points are basically going to be found in the fourth.
The fourth, okay.
That's the big machinery of the
machinery
where all
yeah.
the files and drawers and
Right, and you draw out the card that says motorcycle when you, you know.
Yeah.
So you're matching it up. So you're taking your senses and you're matching up with the understanding of what that,
well,
what
the,
that
the
is.
Basic labeling of it is in the third, and then the elaboration of that is in the fourth.
Labeling, in this instance, the motorcycle sound. So you have sound, right? The rumble.
Right. Then you have an attitude of liking it, disliking it, or wanting to ignore it. Then you have the impulse of forming a prejudice about it, that it's a motorcycle or something. And then motorcycle means all kinds of things to you, and that's the fourth.
Oh, it's your attitude towards the actual word of motorcycle. How you identify or what that means to you.
Well, it's the acceptings or rejecting. That's where it occurs. You're either accepting or rejecting or being indifferent.
Yeah.
So those are the three possibilities in general from the third point.
So feeling in here is, actually it isn't like there's any conscious feeling whatsoever. It's a preconscious awareness of response. If the form is the sound, is the sound.
Maybe
right?
Would feeling be if it was like really loud and it hurt your ears?
Well, not necessarily.
It's
your attitude towards it.
It's before you even have an attitude.
Yeah,
it's
attitude.
It's
before that.
Well, you're talking about feeling now.
Feeling.
Yeah,
yeah, we're on the
so
feeling.
We kept going.
We're back.
So I'm just for sake of
let's work it.
Sort of a linear.
Huh?
Where we're to approach this. So we've got the stimulus.
Mm-hmm.
We've got a pre-conscious response to it, i.e. our feeling. And then we type it, i.e. we've labeled it in perception. We've labeled it motorcycle. And these are all very, very quickly.
Yeah.
And then we go immediately all, as Michael said, all the huge, you know, file cases worth of responses or data we have to motorcycle.
Yeah, I wonder if it's a Harley or like you sort of add on. Is that where you put that?
Well, that's what Michael just said.
That's in the fourth. That's
yeah,
what I meant.
The perception really has to do with acceptance or rejection or basically just indifference. But that's where that occurs.
Well, isn't that two, though?
That's kind of two.
Pleasure, pain,
indifference. Is already there in number two.
Yeah,
difference, that's a sensation. The sensation.
Yeah,
but
it's just
but
the
actually
the
decision
experience.
To accept or reject is not in the... You need to have some kind
like or dislike.
Yeah, you actually have to arrive at a judgment about what you're actually experiencing.
Yeah, irritation
and,
of that voice.
So that's a huge subtle difference. That's a little minuscule but very subtle difference then.
Well,
it's between feeling and perception.
It's not just a
that's
cut
true.
Off.
They don't they
different
blend
islands.
Together.
They're all kind
they're
of like
they're happening really
fast.
Yeah, very
working
very
together.
Right.
Okay, that's a very important point. Do people get that?
Yes.
They happen really fast and they're interpenetrating. Okay. Okay, any questions about the first four? It's helpful to just chew over it.
Yeah.
Because, you know, these take a while.
Well, I just want to make sure with three, perception, that has to do with acceptance or rejection. And then when we go to karmic...
Or indifference.
I'm sorry? Or indifference, okay.
Yeah.
And so then in four, with karmic formations, then we log it into our file folders of, oh yes, that's right, that's the smell of bacon, I can't stand bacon, and bacon is just like pork, and blah, 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 blah.
Well,
right?
it's a kind of crossover, what you did, if that makes sense, between perception, between three and four, because feeling, you label...
With feeling, you have an experience.
But you haven't labeled it yet as...
What it is.
What it is.
Right.
And you do that in...
So that's
three.
Just what your sense organs are telling or
correct.
Bringing in.
Not quite.
But then
a little more than that.
A little more.
A little more than that.
We're going to get to that. We're
going
to get to that. That's actually important, not that we're going to answer everything and just by talking about these skandhas. We're really just talking about how things work on a very fundamental level. That when we talk about experience and what that is, and what's housing it, or housing it, and what making a connection.
Housing is right.
I like it better
this time. I love that word. That's good.
Because, love. I mean, when you get into the word associations, okay, that can be anything and can change all the time, but the associations are generally conditioned by or established in the fourth consciousness. That's where we have this, all of this material of information that we can apply.
Yeah, and attitudes. Backlog.
The attitudes are going to be framed up and held. Or if you look at the list of all the different things on the fourth consciousness, a lot of, they both include virtuous and unvirtuous elements.
51 or more or something.
They're all kind of 50. Well, they're
depends.
Yeah, depending on who's
counting.
Right.
But by the third consciousness, you could also say, "Oh, I love motorcycles."
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, because you're typing it. Yeah,
and now in the fourth, you're going to start to see what that means.
What's it? The fourth is, more extension of that.
Can you explain the fourth a little bit? I mean, like, I think I understand the fourth, but I'd love to hear more about it.
Yeah, what are some more examples? The virtuous are things that are like devotion, and what are some of the, I always wonder about
the
actual
element.
Pile. What's the pile? There are 51 of these things.
You look at something, and before you've even registered what it is, or in the third, you've seen person, or and then it's even before you immediately have a kind of response, or immediately mm-hmm. have a kind the fourth is when you sort of have a judgment about what you've seen in the third, right?
What's that?
It's when you become subjective.
The fourth is when you start to have real justification for what you've done so far.
Yeah, you've already.
And now you can explain it to yourself.
I think the word evoke.
What?
The word evoke was the fourth one, that it evokes feelings and memories and associations.
You made that connection.
Mm-hmm. I like the word association.
Mm-hmm. That's a good one. Judgments is in there on this list, the way he wrote it.
Mm-hmm. I think it's kind of applying a conceptual framework on everything that's 1 through 3. It's like now it's been locked into the framework.
Right.
And the conceptual relationships. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. A lot of all that experience mm-hmm. has been logged mm-hmm. and judged. I think of that as being 4.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and we're dredging up all of that history, so therefore we're drawing boxes around everything, mm-hmm. so we're no longer in a free space.
But it's before action.
Yeah, the action, there's no action. Yeah, there.
We should actually have a list of the elements of the fourth skana for everybody.
Yeah, that
would
help.
Put it on the website. Okay. So everybody just has it.
If you want
to look at it, you'll understand.
There's probably
basic agreements about what is located in the fourth skanda, what is constructed of. And I think that'll give us a better way to just have all of that rather than, or we could bring it in and pass it out. Either way.
She may find a list. Yes?
I understood you to say that becomes a trap. Is there a space for newness, for new perception within that fourth?
Sure.
Yeah, there's always that possibility.
It's happening all the time.
And that's what we're going to talk about now, is sort of how these, like the sense perceptions, can be very awake without concept if we can catch that direct mm-hmm. perception, which art does sometimes. Yes?
Michael said something about the fourth explaining what we did in the first three. Can you explain that? I liked what you were saying.
Me?
Yeah.
Okay. If you really like motorcycles, and you don't need to justify it, okay? Why do I love motorcycles? And everything in your life that has to do with motorcycles that you can bring up and associate with people who you like who have motorcycles, with how shiny it is, with how much fun it is to ride it, everything you can tie it in with, that's where all the work is done. It takes a lot of work in the fourth skanda. You have to rearrange your world to make it go with what you've done so far. And that's where our energy is sapped by this kind of process. We can awake from any part of it when we want to. But this is the part where we piss away our energy, really.
We get trapped.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. The others are happening. The investment gets bigger at that point, okay?
That's a good way to put it. So the next one is consciousness, the fifth one. This is an interesting description. Consciousness is the circumscribed self-referential field of awareness within which we become conscious of the first four skandhas. Consciousness is like a field surrounded by an electric fence. Within the field is our consciousness, governed by motives of self-protection and territoriality. When anything potentially helpful or harmful comes in contact with our consciousness, it mobilizes the other four skandhas to pull in the incoming object if it promises pleasure, to push it away if it appears threatening, or to ignore it if it does neither. So this is sort of the surface level of consciousness, I'd say, because now we're going to go on to the eight consciousnesses and go into them more. Unless, does anyone have any comments on that fifth one? Because this will be more fleshed out here when we turn the page.
So it's either grasping or rejecting or ignoring. You're trying to grab a hold of it. Or
We've done that.
We've already done that.
We've done all of that. Now, this is sort of an analysis of the different mental things that are within that consciousness. Right. Notice that consciousness is not a such a nice word here. It's like lots of spiritual traditions talk about higher consciousness. Mm-hmm. This is limited consciousness, consciousness based upon all the prejudicial work we've assembled.
But consciousness, the potential of consciousness is to be transformed into wisdom. So that's a really important thing. And consciousness, it's dragged down by concepts. But when we liberate concepts, that's the wisdom aspect. So there's a map of how that all is laid out with skandhas and the wisdoms. Yes?
Are there 51 things? Are those the concepts?
51 samskaras. Yeah, the karmic formations, number four.
That's a catalog.
It's one list. Concepts are in a lot of places.
There's a classical definition of 51. I mean, you could think of thousands of ways of describing what's actually in the four skandhas. It's not only 51 things or 51 items, checklist, you know, it's all in a multifarious number. We'll put something online to help sort of have that in one place so you can see how it works. And then it's not an absolute thing.
Right.
It's not only 51 things.
Yeah,
that's
it.
Sandra's
looking it up. Good, good.
Tibetans love this.
Yeah, okay.
I was just curious if 51 samskaras gave me answers.
That's the footnote right here in that book.
Sorry?
What? This footnote here on the first form, the truth, indestructible truth. Is that the book?
Yes. This is the book.
Oh,
this
okay.
is the book. I just took what we're studying right now. From
okay.
There. Muffy, who said
so something? I don't really understand. It mobilizes the other four skandhas to pull in the incoming object. Can you give us an example of what that means? Like, how does consciousness mobilize form, for example?
Well, this, so I think this, when we get in, so now if we go into the eight consciousnesses with the eye and the object and how that all works together, I think that'll make more sense. Okay, does that make sense to move on to that?
Yeah, we should go into the mechanics of it,
yes.
Which is on the other side. The,
yeah, let's do that.
The eight consciousnesses. This will help us understand
right.
what actually we mean by
right,
this
by consciousness.
Word consciousness.
So in a way, the consciousness is on one side, but the real explanation is on the other side. And maybe we'll be able to understand it better.
Consciousness is always trying to keep things running smoothly. That's its job. To justify why we really like what we're doing, to justify why we really hate what's going on, to justify why we can ignore it and go about our business, whatever it is, Consciousness is to keep us within, not to get us disturbed.
Keep us within our boundaries.
Yeah.
Keep basically the electric fence here.
Yeah. Yeah, the electric fence is a good image.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Ouch. So, all right, the eighth consciousness. All right, so the fifth skanda of consciousness is composed of eight aspects, differentiable according to function. These are the eight consciousnesses. They include the five sense consciousnesses, so that's the eye consciousness, which is the aspect of consciousness that registers the visual impressions of the eye organ, and likewise the ear, nose, tongue, and body consciousness, as in the chant that we do, the Heart Sutra. So we have the five sense consciousnesses. The five sense consciousnesses are concept-free. They merely register the sense experience. This is really important. So this is why, like Trungpa Rinpoche taught us through that method, that sense perceptions free of concept, that direct perception of reality. And that was the method he used through art, through just a lot of different interactive experiences people had, that was kind of a direct relationship to reality without superimposing a lot of concept on it. So, do you want to say anything about that? Okay. So anyway, we can talk about that and think about it further. But the sixth consciousness is that aspect of the consciousness that registers the mind organ's perception of mental objects. The sixth consciousness is also concept-free, insofar as it only registers the direct and unmediated experience of its object without adding onto it. So Trungpa Rinpoche, in Volume 1 of Profound Treasury, talks about the sixth consciousness as being kind of the coordinator of the sense consciousnesses. So there's the mind, basically, it's the mind part to those perceptions. Does that make sense? Is that right? Or is that
Right? It's called an organ. It's called the mind's organ.
That's hard to imagine.
It's just you have five organs of perception here: eye, ear, nose, tongue, and then the mind is basically the organ, as it were, an organ which arranges or coordinates,
yeah.
Basically handles the immense amount of material that's coming in through the other five. So
signal
we're
receiver.
Not overwhelmed by
that's
it.
Good.
It's a signal receiver.
So, oh, sure.
So is the idea that there's a stream of thoughts and perceptions and the mind consciousness is the one that's just, you know, monitoring that without labeling it?
No, it's not all that complicated.
Okay.
Supposing can a rock have a dream?
No.
Okay. So if you have a dream, your mind has, I'm being angry at this, or I'm being attacked by this, or I'm in love with this, whatever. Is there any doubt that both halves are in your own mind? Okay?
Right.
So it's the same in awakening. Take that dream and now look at waking experience. You can't have a self and other except as your mind makes self and other. Obviously, you can't have it in a dream otherwise, because there is no stuff coming in. But even if stuff is coming in, you still need to say, this is me seeing that. And only a mind can say, this part's the me, and this is...
Isn't that the seventh?
That's the seventh.
That's the seventh,
the
yeah.
Yeah.
We're on the sixth. Right.
Which is just this, the sixth.
The sixth is kind of a general organizer
and just
coordinator.
Organizes, so we learn how to coordinate between seeing the door and being able to open the door.
That's a good point.
Not blanking out. I mean, this is not a concept, it's just behavior capacity we have with coordinating right. our sense perceptions and movement. We're not stepping into walls or anything else. We, you know, this is how
right. like driving a car. I mean, you're doing all sorts of things. You're looking, you're hearing, you're holding the steering wheel, but the mind has got to relate to all these things. And coordinated.
This is
right?
before you talk about thinking about anything.
Yeah.
We're still not thinking.
We're not
about
even
it.
Thinking.
We're not
yet.
Carrying around all of our stuff, our drama issues that we may be having at the same time. That's not driving
that's
the car.
That's why it's concept free. That's what concept free means.
Right. Right. Okay, so the seventh. Now we get into real juicy territory. The seventh consciousness is the creator of duality. Here, the bare experience given by the six senses is separated into I and other. The seventh consciousness adds the idea of I, me, and mine onto our experience of the six consciousnesses. It taints every experience with the idea of a self and imposes the false idea of a self on everything that happens. So the word klesha, or afflicted emotions, applies here. This is where that whole dance starts, happens.
So I'd heard that, I remembered that the seventh consciousness is where, that's sort of where the kleshas hang out. And that's
yeah.
basically because that's where the sense of the self is
right.
introduced.
Right. So this is a very, very important point. Because how do we attain liberation? It's to clear away the two obscurations. So it's like the sun and the clouds. And you can't see the sun if it's really thick, fog, cloudy. But to clear those away, those two obscurations are the kleshas and the it's called primitive beliefs about reality, which basically is a false belief about the self and how things actually appear. So those are the main obscurations are the kleshas, the emotional upheavals, and what's the root of the emotional upheaval? It's clinging to a self, right? I mean, it all goes back to the same root. So this self and other and this seventh consciousness is a really critical thing to work with and try to understand, because this is where the me, my, mine, I, this is where it's explained, and it's really all about this false idea of a self. Everything's dependent on that.
Can I ask you a question, Sandra?
Okay.
Of all the different types of emotionality that can occur, what we call kleshas, which do you think is the easiest to recognize and which is the hardest? Which one does a conversation go to immediately? The easy one. Every time we have a discussion of this, what emotion do we talk about?
Suffering.
No,
well, that's a general category. That's
oh, you're talking about.
Well, there you go. She said it.
What?
Anger.
Anger. Yeah, the obvious, the most easy one. Okay.
Trapped.
It's a little harder to see that you're driven by envy, right? The hardest one.
Ignorance.
Yes, good.
That's
okay,
ignorance.
That's an important point
right.
to remember, okay? So instead of always driving the conversation towards anger management, which is what all the media does, let's try to see if we can
ignorance management.
Ignorance.
I like
that. Very bumper sticker.
Ignorance management. Right.
Yeah.
Right.
We're not usually talking about our own ignorance
Okay, yes. Okay, the two obscurations are the kleshas, and one is afflicted emotions.
The kleshas are the afflicted emotions, and the knowledge obscurations. That's the
and
second
the
one.
Knowledge.
They're called the knowledge obscurations.
Or wisdom.
Or
there are
wisdom
more things under knowledge obscurations. As well.
What's that?
That there are lots of knowledge obscurations.
Well, they're mainly, it's our view of self. That's a knowledge obscurations, because we don't see what's really there, which is, it does not add up to a self. Sorry, it just doesn't. I mean,
but at the same
it's
time,
all these pieces.
Interestingly, this seventh consciousness is not just only editing all of this other stuff. It does that. The editing goes back and then redresses or reframes all of our perceptions, the eye, ear, nose, tongue, body, and mind. So they become, infected with this fundamental delusion of me, when in fact there is sight, there is seeing, there is hearing, there is sound. These things occur. They're not permanent, but they occur. But that's not me. There's no me there. The me is the habit we have of the seventh consciousness, which has been going on for time immemorial, imposing this notion and constellating everything around this idea of a self. Why we want to study these other consciousnesses is because they actually help us by just seeing the components that there's no self there. We can actually see that. In terms of the,
So how does the seventh consciousness relate to karmic formations? Because it sounds like karmic formations involves duality, because you're passing judgment.
Right.
Yeah, so you're going to get to that a little later, I think.
I think it's pre-conscious, though.
Yeah, that's an earlier stage, right?
Yeah, it's pre-awareness, actually. It seems as though the
seventh... Even though it says judgment, that sounds like...
But it's almost instinctive.
Yeah.
Like you said that. Noise. You said that. Evoke. Allow. Like there's this instinctual reaction, but that is, it isn't labeled yet. It's just
so there's no duality there. We're just instinctively passing a quick judgment.
Uh-huh.
Well, wait a minute. No, let's just go back and stay with consciousness for a moment. We are understanding how everything is happening simultaneously. It's not like there's some kind of actual temporal sequence going on. This is all simultaneous.
That helps.
That
helps.
And we have to divide it up to talk about it. Yes.
But also, in some ways, I would think the karmic formations. It's pre-consciousness, right? It's unconscious. Categorization.
It's unconscious until it's worked on. Right now, the roots of taking the self to be real are rather harder to come by. What's most accessible to us are those trees of klesha. So, in some sense, we're starting to cut down the trees and then the roots. Then we might find we can talk about the roots, which I think is what you're going
to
do.
But we've been talking about the self all along. I mean, that's what we started with. And that's, we've been, in the past, we worked a lot with kleshas and lojong and other things. We talked about emotions, but we never really went into what is a self and why are we so clinging to that? So I think in this particular material, we've taken a different tact here. And I think people, we're starting to look at that a little more. What is this self?
So we can say the third consciousness, to go back just for a moment. We're talking about responsiveness. Just some preliminary responsiveness, right? Third, in the third skanda, when we talk about, you were bringing this up, Muffy. Weren't you?
Yeah.
The question of, so the responsiveness is there. When you get into consciousness, we have the capacity to make changes. We have the capacity to actually, we can actually change how we view things in our consciousness. Mm. We can't do it on an unconscious level.
Right.
And so just one more thing to go back to this word pre-conscious, which is a very important, actually a wonderful term. Because it has to do with a dimension or realm that's functional before our consciousness gets involved with it. And as we sort of learn how to basically turn down all this machinery of mind where it winds down and gives this and the space arises, or we discover the space in which things can actually be seen directly and clearly, then many of those factors which we call preconscious become available to us, as it were, instead of just being shrouded in automaticity.
Right.
Automaticity.
Automaticity.
It's okay.
Whoa.
So you make that up?
No, that's a word. This is one you don't hear often.
No, time for Scrabble.
Before we leave the Sabbath, you mentioned when you dream, right? And when you wake up, realizing that all of that is part of you, all of that, it's very gestalt-y, but all of it is you, and then coming into doing real life and understanding that you're dragging all this other stuff with you in your perceptions and your reactions. I thought that was really interesting. Thank you for that. That's going to give me food for thought.
The dream analogy is one of the most powerful analogies that Buddhism has to teach with you. Mm-hmm. And we use it all the time at many different levels.
Let's move on to the eighth consciousness. Okay. The alaya, the storehouse consciousness, where karmic seeds that have been created are stored. This is the eighth consciousness. Every experience that we have ever had has left an impression on our consciousness. This impression remains from one moment to the next, from one year to the next, from one lifetime to the next, until it is resolved through the natural occurrence of one's suffering or through deliberate spiritual practice. This is what karma is, namely the collection of impressions that we have received since beginningless time. The sum total of these impressions exists at the most subtle level of our consciousness, even when, at death, all the more superficial levels of consciousness disappear. This most subtle alaya consciousness remains. It exits the body at the moment of death and passes on to a new birth, carrying all of our karma.
Can I just bring something in, because this is really critical? This is Buddhism. Nothing is permanent, including this karma. Mm-hmm. When it's stated as such, it doesn't mean it's some kind of solid thing like a monolithic stone that is buried in a tomb. And, you know, we have to deal with it until the end of time, because it's everything in a state of flux and change. This is one of the things we studied last summer. You were in the class when we discussed this karma. This is the most remarkable understanding, a very helpful understanding. You understand that karma itself is changing. It's not a solid thing. We have a problem with language in the West, because and many Buddhist teachers don't realize what happens when they translate into Western languages the notion of karma. It's not a solid, final thing. I mean, Hindu karma is more traditionally more I view it as some kind of solidity. Yeah, you got to go through 15 lifetimes because
Ken MacLeod says that, you know, the better word for karma, that the words cause and effect are really give the wrong impression. Yeah. Seed is the right term.
Uh-huh.
That a seed will become a tree given right
the
causes
right
and conditions, but it's not a seed and your oak tree shows up 100 years later.
Right.
Your experiences are never stopping. You're always experiencing something, so you're adding.
Yeah, you're adding to it all the time. And you can add to it in a positive way or a negative way.
Or you can free it.
You can liberate. That's the thing. So this is this funny text here in terms of what it means. Until it's resolved through natural occurrence of one's suffering.
Yeah.
So I guess it's like if you kill, you know, you kill a bird and then... I'm sure there's some relationship there that you would experience.
Where did you get this?
Comes from Reggie Ray.
Yeah, see, he doesn't understand.
He doesn't understand
Ati.
Oh, Reggie
because
doesn't?
There is no deliberate spiritual practice in Ati. And Ati, Maha-Ati, I just want to bring it up because you're going to encounter it, and I don't want to say we can't.
Well, this is the Hinayana section.
I know, but we still have
that's
to understand. I know, but deliberate spiritual practice tends to just make this whole thing too solid.
Because it's the Hinayana. That's the way he's presenting it.
Yeah, I think really discussing it in terms of...
Okay, we can discuss
liberation.
Go ahead.
We talk about liberation when we dedicate the merit.
Right.
What does liberation mean? And liberation has to do with fundamentally the direct seeing of reality. That is the liberation itself. It's not working hard, you know, throwing yourself on the floor and working yourself into a sweat. I just want to understand people's associations might start build up around this notion I have to struggle to make this work. when struggle is not really the answer. So, you know, I just, I'm sorry.
That's okay.
Reject that.
That's okay. But also it points to another point, is that the view, wherever we are when we're speaking about Buddhism, you have to always say, where are we in the view? Are we, you know, are we at the highest view? You know, are we at the view of Mahayana, working with others? Are we at the view, the Hinayana, the beginning level of how it's presented? So I have to disagree in that way, because I think it's coming from the Hinayana view.
Can I bring up like a piece of personal experience that I do not understand?
Okay.
Okay, so just recently, while working with this material, what came up was the body I had buried underneath the cement in the house of my parents when I was a very small child.
This is a dream.
This came up somehow. It was provoked by something more recent, that someone might have brought a false accusation against me, but I do not understand how karma works and why this would come up in my mind. I very much doubt that within this lifetime I actually buried a body under cement. Something in this practice and in the working of something more recent brought up what I could expose, and would someone discover that I had done this heinous deed.
In your dream.
In your dream. So you're saying there was a seed planted perhaps a long time ago. By causes and conditions.
But a more recent experience caused it to come up in my dream.
Weird.
I cannot explain karma.
So was it a vivid dream? Was it vivid, or was it like dream? I mean, it was real.
It was dream, and it had content. Okay, it was. Is this going to be exposed?
The feeling.
Yeah.
That's interesting.
The guilty crime is not going to be exposed by some more recent things that happened.
But if it's a dream, it's not necessarily a literal body, right? Or literal cement.
I'm not going to speculate on this because I don't claim to understand karma, okay?
Mm-hmm. Well, I guess, do you expect that you can retrace, that you can come up with explanations for every event? I mean, because it seems like just not knowing doesn't seem like, that seems like more than normal.
So that seems also like you could just continue solidifying conclusions of what you think you are over and over and over.
There was some seed, and I don't know why the seed is there and where it came from, whether I believe in previous lives or don't believe in it, I just don't know.
Is this a reoccurring dream?
When it came up, I realized that the occurrence had been there and that I had ignored it for decades and decades.
Wow, interesting.
So back to the karma being not something that's fixed necessarily. And so setting it free, that's this process, that's this study.
The path is liberation. The path is liberation. It's easy, we should really try to understand that the path is the goal.
Right.
We're not trying to get beyond the goal, we're trying to actually just simply live the goal, which is the path itself. The path is enough. Do you understand what I mean by that?
Yes,
I don't know if I deeply understand it, but as we
engage with Dharma and actually engage and bring our experience onto the path of Dharma, which we're going to be learning about and how which we're studying, is that we begin to realize this is really the goal of fundamentally being, is to actually liberate experience. And that the difficulty or the pain and the suffering which we have incurred in the first place, or which why we are so confused, is precisely where we are, what we're here to work on, as opposed to just ignore or pretend it isn't there, or look some other direction.
Or use it. Use it to create more.
Well, it uses us. I mean, that's really what's happening.
Right. Re-solidify.
We may think we're using it, but.
So I just want to point to the last paragraph, because we are out of time. It is important not to think of the alaya as a thing. And here's where the analogy of the storehouse breaks down. All of the five skandhas are momentary, including the eight consciousnesses. One moment of consciousness with the alaya as its most subtle level carrying our particular karma dies. As it does so, it transmits this karmic load to the next moment of consciousness. Thus, what we call the alaya is really the succession of moments of the most subtle dimension of our consciousness. So all these little chunks, chunk, chunk, chunk. And you see that when you meditate, right? They're just little chunks. And we string it all together, and then we plaster a name on it. And there we have me, you know. So, any further last-minute comments or questions? Or
good stuff.
There's more next week. It's going to be pretty exciting. You know, I have a big picture of the Wheel of Life.
That would be great.
I have it. We'll bring it in.
That'd be great.
We have to get. We'll get the.
We brought that in one time a long time ago.
Yeah, exactly.
It'd be helpful to bring it again so you can actually see why there is a Wheel of Life. Why when in Buddhism we talk about it, and how it actually consists of all the elements of what we're dealing with in terms of ignorance, confusion, and the path of liberation.
That'd be it's wonderful. The heaven realm and the hell
The realm. It's all on there. Right. So also we'll point you to something we put online a while back. I don't know if it maybe is in the unit on the Abhidharma, maybe a year ago when we did it in the fall. I'm not sure, but we'll let you know, because there'll be, and there are many online
the
illustrations.
The link you're talking about is broken, but I think we can
Good, okay. all right, good. I'm glad you're on top of that.
I'll throw another reference.
There's great things at the Rubin Museum site, too. Okay.
Oh, yeah.
So let's, dedicate the merit. Michael, did you have something?
No, okay. Are we done? Do we have a point to end?
Yes, this is the end. We'll see you next week.